Ladies and gentlemen, your conference call is about to begin. Here's your moderator, Mr. David J. Russen.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us today. My name is David Russen, and I am Director of Islamist Watch here at the Middle East Forum. Islamist Watch investigates and combats the nonviolent agendas of radical Islam throughout the West, and today I'm going to discuss some recent trends in the battle against nonviolent jihad, or what we might call stealth jihad, and what those trends may hold for the future. First off, it is important to understand that all flavors of jihad directed against the West share a common long-term goal: destroy our liberal democratic system and replace it with one governed by Sharia law. We obviously do not want that to happen. Now, there are two general paths to accomplishing this aim. Violent jihad, as we witness on September 11th, seeks to cow the West into submission through the use of terror. Nonviolent jihad, in contrast, is more subtle. It attempts to achieve the same ends, but through subversion. So rather than setting off bombs or crashing planes, nonviolent jihadists work within the system to slowly chip away at the foundations of Western societies. By that I mean free speech, equality under the law, respect for human rights, and so forth. Specifically, nonviolent jihadists employ media, courts, schools, and sympathetic governments to try to win privileges for Muslims, to shut down criticism of Islam, to insinuate aspects of Sharia law into our lives, and thus to change our societies fundamentally. That is the stealth jihad in a nutshell. It is death by a thousand cuts. And thus, it can easily fly underneath the radar, making it in many ways even more difficult to counteract than violent jihad. Hence, while terrorism gets headlines, it is nonviolent jihad that often gets the real results. And let me just cite for you a few recent examples of a creeping Sharia in the West. The British Department of Health agreed to exempt Muslims from regulations that require doctors and nurses to maintain bare arms in order to prevent the spread of disease in hospitals. Now, so the logic goes, bare arms would infringe upon a Muslim's modesty, so we cannot have that and we have to change the regulations. A public school in Denmark banned fathers from a parent-teacher meeting out of deference to Muslim mothers who were demanding gender-segregated environments. And the city of Minneapolis, Minnesota, believe it or not, has been pushing Sharia-compliant mortgages. The list goes on, and this is just a small section, selection of how the rules of Western societies are being rewritten to conform more closely to Islamist norms. And this is the stealth jihad in action. Now, I would like to discuss two important trends in this battle, one negative and one positive. First, the bad news, the proliferation of self-censorship. Now, one of the areas in which nonviolent Islamists have achieved greatest success is in the curtailing of freedom of speech. Needless to say, free speech is not only our most fundamental liberty, but if we cannot speak openly about radical Islam, then we have little chance of defeating it. So free speech is incredibly important. And we're already familiar with some of the ways in which speech about Islam is being infringed. Over in the Netherlands, for example, a member of parliament, Geert Wilders, is on trial, going to go on trial in October on the charge of insulting Muslims because he dared to suggest in a film that the Quran may help inspire terrorists. But even more dangerous, I think, than such legal nightmares is self-censorship. That is, governments, media, other public entities consciously choosing to restrict their own speech about Islam out of either fear or political correctness. And examples of self-censorship have been everywhere in recent months. And I'm sorry to say that Americans are some of the worst offenders. For example, many of you probably heard how Comedy Central censored images of Muhammad and even mentions of Muhammad's name in a recent episode of South Park. Earlier this year, images of Muhammad were also quietly pulled from New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art, again due to Muslim sensibilities. And then, of course, there is the Obama administration, which is sort of turned into the king of the self-censorship castle. We need to look no further than the Fort Hood report commissioned by the defense secretary to investigate the events leading up to the massacre carried out by Major Hassan. The report makes absolutely no mention of Islam, despite the fact that Hassan was literally handing out business cards that identified himself as a soldier of Allah. Likewise, in the Quadrennial Defense Review, the Quadrennial Homeland Security Review, documents that are intended to outline our approach to strategic challenges, the words Islam and Jihad are nowhere to be found these days. The same goes for the National Security Strategy. During the Bush era, it declared that, quote, the struggle against militant Islamic radicalism is the great ideological conflict of the early years of the 21st century. Sounds pretty good. Now that language is gone. In its place, we have vague references to nameless, faceless extremists, violent extremists that don't tell us anything about who the enemy is. So that's the first big trend we're seeing, self-censorship. And it's not only undermining a fundamental freedom, it's crippling our ability to defend ourselves. So that's a very bad trend. Now that I've depressed everyone, I'll give you a bit of good news and discuss a second trend. Over the past year, and especially over the past several months, we're starting to see for the first time a real pushback against the notion that societies must bend over backwards to accommodate Islam. This is the second big trend, and believe it or not, it's being led by Europe. It's a pushback from the ground up. It's driven by citizens who, for a lack of a better expression, are sick and tired, and they're not going to take anymore. A pivotal episode, I believe, occurred last November. One of the populist parties in Switzerland managed to place a measure on a nationwide ballot to ban the construction of new minarets. These are the spires attached to mosques. And it's a very visible manifestation of Islam in Europe. The political elite, including the Swiss government itself, came out strongly against the referendum. But what happened? Well, Swiss voters went to the polls, and 57% of them approved the measure. And the ban is now part of the Swiss constitution. There are going to be no new minarets built in Switzerland, period. Now, the construction of minarets is not exactly the most pressing issue facing Europe, yet this ban is very important because, for one thing, it demonstrates the steep divide between the average man and the elites who claim to represent him. Indeed, the European man on the street has been concerned about Islam's growing presence on the continent, the apparent failures of integration, etc., for a very long time. But for decades, the mainstream political parties in Europe have been ignoring these concerns. This has resulted in the rise of populist and decidedly non-mainstream political parties, because they're often the only ones willing to discuss these issues openly, although they often don't do so in productive ways. But I believe that the mainstream parties are starting to wake up a little bit. And indeed, following fast on the heels of the Swiss minaret ban, we've witnessed a remarkable sight, a veritable tidal wave of proposals now to ban burqas and niqabs, that is, Islamic attire covering the face of women. This is much more significant than the minarets issue for a number of reasons. Burqas and niqabs are a security threat, and they may even violate the human rights of the person wearing it if they're being forced into wearing it. Moreover, burqas and niqabs are a clear symbol of radical Islam and separatism. Now, virtually every country in Europe now is in the midst of debates about legislating bans on these face-covering veils, and there's been a lot of progress on the issue in the last few months. And surprisingly, it's the mainstream center-left and center-right political parties that are for once listening to the people and getting out in front. So last month in Belgium, the lower house of parliament there became the first in Europe to pass a law prohibiting the wearing of face-covering attire in public, backed up by fines and even prison terms. The legislation was approved without dissent, and it now awaits ratification by the upper house. Just last week, the French cabinet followed suit. It agreed on a very aggressive bill banning burqas and niqabs in public. And the especially interesting is that men who force their women to wear such attire, under this law, they would be punished by up to a year in prison. And this bill is going to be taken up by Parliament this summer. In Italy, several northern towns have already implemented burqa bans. Over in Canada, the government of Quebec has tabled similar legislation. Now, this is what I would call a trend. And there are other signs as well that mainstream parties are beginning to push back a little against Islamism and standing up for Western values. Last year, for example, Canada published a new citizenship guide with surprisingly sharp language. It states, and I quote, "Canada's openness and generosity do not extend to barbaric cultural practices." And it cites things such as spousal abuse and genital mutilation. These days, it often seems as if the one Western government that does not seem to get it is the one we have in Washington, D.C., and we need to work to change that. So in summary, I just want to say that nonviolent and violent Islam, jihad and Islamism differ in many obvious ways, but in one way in particular is often overlooked, and we should note it here. That way is the following. Terrorists can manage to kill people regardless of how much effort we put into trying to stop them. There's no foolproof counterterrorism strategy. We're never in complete control. But with nonviolent jihad, stealth jihad, this succeeds only if and when we let it succeed. When societies bend rules to accommodate Islamist demands, when governments open their doors to the representatives of radical Islam, and when we censor ourselves. Hence, we have a choice and we hold all the cards. When Islamists demand accommodations that would never be granted to any other group, there's a simple prescription. Just say no. And I'm happy to report, as I did previously, that there are some signs that Europe is beginning to learn that vital lesson. Now the U.S., from the Obama administration on down, needs to do the same. Thank you, and I would be happy to take a few questions.
Thank you. To join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. I will announce each caller prior to bringing you into the conference. Please remember, if you have your phone on mute, to take it off mute when you are selected to ask your question. Again, to join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. And at this time, we don't have any questions in our queue, so I am going to turn it back over to you, Mr. Russin, for additional comments.
Yes, I could offer an additional note or two of hope. You know, fighting against radical Islam can seem very daunting, and there are so many big challenges out there. For example, today everybody is thinking about the Iranian nuclear program, incredibly important challenge. And the fact of the matter is that you or I or the man on the street, we're not going to be able to affect very much whether Iran gets a nuclear weapon. However, we can do a lot pushing back against the stealth jihad here at home. We are not defenseless against it. Concerned citizens have a vital role to play. Many cases of Islamist infiltration involve, stuff going on right in your own neighborhood, a local school, a local government, a local business. So, as the mantra goes, if you see something, say something. If you see this infiltration taking place, if your kids are being indoctrinated at school, if special privileges are being granted to Muslims at work, call people, complain, contact your elected representatives, work with neighbors, make your voices heard. This is a type of counter-jihad activity, if you will, that anybody can take part in. And in order to fight back against the nonviolent radical Islam, individual citizens have to get involved. Any questions?
No questions at this time. So I will turn it back over to you to close.
Okay. Well, if there are no questions, I guess I will just thank everybody for joining us today. And just want to say that we need to be as proactive in opposing radical Islam as the radical Islamists are in advancing it. So thank you, and I hope you will come to our website, islamist-watch.org, to read more about what we are doing.